I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Repeat after me. It's all about food. And when you go through the next hour, you're going to agree with me, if you don't already, that it is indeed all about food. How are you on this August 5th, 2014? We've got a nice 88 degrees Fahrenheit here in New York City. And, you know, I'm not even feeling it. It's just been so lovely. It's been one of the best summers ever here in New York. Not sure why, but I'm not complaining. I'm loving it. Now, before we get going with my first guest, I wanted to tell you the great news. Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit organization, has apps. We've got apps. So if you go to the home page and scroll down on the right side where the widgets are, you can find the iPhone and iPad apps on the Apple Store. There's a link there, and we have an Android app. And this way you don't have to put in responsibleeatingandliving.com because it's delicious, I know, and nutritious, but it's kind of heavy to write. So we've got apps. I'm very excited about that, and check it out. Okay, first guest up, Matt Ball. He is the author of many essays and several books, including the Animal Activist Handbook, and now the new one, The Accidental Activist. In 2005, he was inducted into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame, and he has done so much for this planet and for animals, and I want to welcome him to It's All About Food. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm great. It's an honor to be with you today.
Yes, it is. So let's just sit in that honor for a moment. you've done so much for so long. How do you keep going?
Well, I've been honored to work with a lot of great people over the years. I draw a lot of inspiration from my friends and coworkers. So it's just been a great ride.
All right, I read your book, and I got a few things out of it, and one thing is you've learned a lot over the years.
Right, and I've made a lot of mistakes. I was an angry kid in college when I found out about factory farming, and I basically acted out of anger for a long time instead of acting out of what would be the best way to create change in the world.
And what is the best way, in your humble opinion?
In my humble opinion, it's trying to reach people where they are, instead of starting where we want them to be. And it's basic psychology. If you tell people to do something, they don't want to do that.
We're all 3 years old in our bodies, right?
Right. You know, we're all invested in this inner monologue that we have, that we're good people. And so if you tell people that what they're doing is bad and everything they've done is bad for years, they're not going to want to believe that. They're going to be invested in making you the issue, and to try to protect their ego, their idea of them being a good person. But the point isn't about who's a good person and who's a bad person. The point is about trying to make a difference in the world, given that most people don't know what goes on in factory farms. If we can help people understand this, then they can make more informed choices in going forward, as opposed to telling people that they're bad and what they're doing is bad.
All right. First thing you just said, you think that people don't know what's going on in factory farms, and I find that hard to believe today.
It is hard to believe, but I hear from activists all the time who say, you know, I was on a college campus today, or I was leafleting at a farmer's market, and somebody came back to me and said, I had no idea what was going on, you know, or they said, you know, I thought it was bad, but I had no idea it was this bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably the best story I ever heard was my wife and I were holding a sign once that said, stop eating animals. And a woman said, who eats animals?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, right. I eat steak and right. Uh-huh. Who eats animals? Well, did she learn something from you two?
Actually, her daughter pulled her aside and said, talk to her. So it was very amusing.
So, oh, sad and amusing. Well, yeah, you know, people may not know, but I think many don't know because they don't want to know.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it's much easier to not know, to be able to go along with everything you've done growing up, what your family does, what your friends do, what your habits are, what your traditions are. I mean, it's not an easy thing to change. And it's a problem for people like me who have been vegan for a long time. You know, to me, it's very easy. To me, it is my habits, it's my traditions and everything. And it's hard to remember what it was like 25 years ago, 27 years ago, when I first learned about these things. And I didn't want to change. I didn't want to know. When I first went vegetarian, I thought I was starving. I had no idea what I was doing. And I, you know, I went back to eating meat because I thought it was safer. I thought it was, you know, the safest thing to do, the most known thing to do. So I went through everything that I see people going through now when they see a video online or when they get a booklet or when they go to see a documentary. You know, they don't want to know, or they don't have any idea what to do next.
All right, let's talk about this key word, anger. There's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of anger with vegetarians and vegans amongst themselves. What are we going to do about this?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that it's entirely understandable. I mean, it's an entirely human reaction to be angry when you see what goes on in factory farms, when you see what goes on in slaughterhouses, and then when you are faced with indifference or people who just don't want to know. So it's entirely understandable. It's entirely human to be angry. The difficult thing for me that literally took me years was to get over the anger instead of arguing with people or fighting with people or even, you know, fighting with other vegetarians or other animal rights people who didn't view things exactly like I do. That's the easiest way to deal with things, is to just go with the anger. But if we really want to make a difference, we have to step back from the anger, because people don't react constructively to anger in general. And
They don't.
And it's the carrot and the stick. You're not gonna beat many people into becoming a vegetarian or into becoming vegan. But it's just, you know, it's hard to take people where they are when you so badly want them to be where you are, because that's, you know, then there will be fewer animal suffering. So I totally and completely understand the urge to say, you know, you have to be vegan, because that's, you know, what we've decided is the best course for us and for the animals. But that's not the best way for getting people to take the first step towards helping animals, which is what everyone has to do. Everyone has to take the first step, instead of us insisting on them taking the last step. I mean, the longest journey starts with the first step.
Now, there are, I don't want to focus too much on everything in the vegetarian movement that's ugly, but just another moment, and then we'll get back to the real ugliness on the planet. And that is, there seem to be two factions, where there are the all-or-nothing abolitionist people, and then there are the welfareists. And your book gives the reasons why it's important to move in small steps.
Well, it's not really important to move in small steps. I mean, it would be great if we could get big steps. It's just not the way the world works. I went for years wanting the big steps, wanting everything done right now, and the key to creating real change. And it was obvious if I had just thought back on how I evolved over time. I evolved in fits and starts over the course of years, and yet once I was vegan for a while, I wanted everyone to go vegan overnight, even though that's not even how it happened with me, and it's not how it happens for a lot of my friends. I actually know more people who went vegan overnight who went back to eating meat than I know people who went vegan overnight and stayed vegan.
Okay. Now, who should read The Accidental Activist?
Well, I think anyone who's interested in and being an activist for the animals would find something in it of use. I mean, there are essays that I've written over the last 20 decades, and then there are essays by seven other people as well that bring in their unique perspective on things. I've gotten a lot of feedback from people, from new people and from longtime people who enjoy it. When Bruce Friedrich and I wrote the Animal Activist Handbook, we wrote it more like a textbook, a linear argument, starting from first principles and working it down to specifics in activism. So that's more of a, that book is more of a how-to book. And then my wife, Ann Green, wanted a more personal book for the second book, which is why it's a collection of essays that stand on their own instead of tearing it apart and trying to work it into another linear narrative. So, and if you want the how-to of activism starting from first principles, then the book I wrote with Bruce Friedrich, The Animal Activist Handbook, is probably the better place to start. But The Accidental Activist is more personal. A lot of times people react better to stories.
Yep.
And something personal, how something happened for another human being as opposed to a linear textbook type narrative. So the Accidental Activist is much more of a personal narrative, personal story.
All right, personal story. You've raised a daughter as a vegan, and she's in college now. There must be a few stories there.
Ellen is really great. I have to admit, when Ann and I got married, I thought it was just a course of nature, a rite of passage that all children rebel against their parents, and everyone warned us, you know, oh, she's going to want to eat meat and like in the future, but she never has. She's just a great kid, and we've always tried to be honest with her at an age appropriate level. All through these 20 years. And I think that she's always respected that and understood that we're being honest with her as opposed to forcing her to do something because it's what we say to do. And I think that really resonates with her. And I think it's interesting. Her life shows the power of example. I mean, she's influenced a lot of her friends over the years to stop eating chicken or to go vegetarian, and sometimes she didn't even know this. She was in line at a concession stand at a track meet when she was in seventh grade, and the best runner on the team was in eighth grade and was in front of her with a friend, and she ordered like a pretzel or something. And the friend said, "Don't you want a chicken sandwich or something?" And I don't remember her name, but the best runner said, "No, I'm a vegetarian." And Ellen said, "Oh, really? You're a vegetarian too?" Mm-hmm. Or "I am too," or something like that. And the girl turned around and said, "Well, yeah, you're the reason I'm a vegetarian." And, you know, Ellen didn't even know this. So it's a good story of the power that we set as our example, even if we don't necessarily know it or if we don't necessarily get the feedback right away.
Wow, that is a good one. I love that. And it does show how important it is to follow our beliefs and live them and be an example.
And be an example of someone that other people would like to be like. I mean, if we're just angry and misanthropic.
Not a good example.
It's not going to cause a lot of people to say, "Ooh, I want to be like that. No going to parties, always angry with people. That's looking good."
Okay, now semantics here. There seems to be some issues whether we do our work with using the word vegan or using the word vegetarian.
Well, I think it really depends on the audience. 20 years ago, pretty much no one had heard the word vegan in the general public. And as time went on, vegan kind of became a joke line in comic strips and the like.
It still is.
It still is, but there are audiences, there are places where the word vegan is now something that's interesting or is intriguing to people. It's not something that makes people say, "Ugh, veganism." They're like, "Oh, yeah, you know, my friend so-and-so is a vegan, but I don't think I could ever do it. And then, you know, being there as an example, or having the stories there, you can tell them about how you changed, or what things they can try, is useful. Now, in other audiences, you're just going to get people saying, no, I could never be vegan, and that's it. And the word vegetarian often is a better way to get people interested in considering the issues at hand. And since the majority of people evolve, they take the first step and they give up this, and they take the second step and they give up this, and then they take the third step and they give up the next thing to become vegetarian, it's not as though we have to be standing at the far distance from them at the pure veganism thing. We can move over towards them and help them start by taking that first step. So it really depends on your audience. It depends on the society you're in, I think, to determine which word works best.
Now, you talk about in your book that some of the things that we may do actually may cause more harm to animals when we think that we're doing some good. And one of them is when people decide to stop eating red meat, they go towards what I like to call the feathered vegetable and the scaly vegetable, chicken and fish, and that can actually do even more harm.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Nick Cooney, in his book Veganomics, he looks at the biggest study that went over people's food choices and found that people who give up red meat eat 60% more chicken, and they also eat more fish. And since it takes about 250 chickens to provide the same number of meals as one steer, and you're causing 250 times more animals to die. But even more than that is that chickens suffer amazingly and unbelievably in factory farms, and they've been bred so that they're in pain the whole last part of their lives. They grow so fast that their joints cannot take the weight. And I don't want to go into all the horrors of factory farms, but chickens and laying hens have the absolute worst situations out there. And if we do anything that causes anyone to eat more chickens, then we're causing more suffering.
And personally, I don't think they're any healthier than meat. There may be a few little things in red meat that are worse than chicken, but overall, in the grand scheme of things, it's not good food for us to be eating.
And there are a lot of things about, since chickens are raised so intensively and they're given so many antibiotics, and there's so much contamination with chicken, that there's a whole other range of health issues associated with chickens. So a lot of people who make the health argument now for vegetarianism are not saying, you know, red meat this, red meat that. They're pointing out all the health issues that come with eating chicken, because unfortunately, chicken is considered a healthy food, or at least a healthy alternative, by society as a whole. So we have to point out to people how unhealthy chicken really is.
That's right. So you've been doing this for decades now, and what's next for you in your activism?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I don't really know, because the world is such a different place now than when I went vegetarian 27 years ago. And we've learned so much, and you know, activism has evolved immensely over the years. So I'm not exactly sure where I fit in at this particular point. But I do want, what I want to do is I want to continue to inspire people to pursue effective activism that makes a real difference in the world, and to raise money to fund people doing effective activism.
Because it is all about money. It is all about money.
Yeah, and we're really limited by the amount of money we have, because the more money we have, the more people we can reach through documentaries, through online ads, through booklets, through humane education. Because there are a lot more people out there who would do this work if they had the opportunity than we're able to fund at this time.
That's right. Well, Matt, thank you for speaking with me today on It's All About Food, and all the best with the Accidental Activist. And you can visit Matt Ball at his blog, A Meaningful Life, A Better World, mattball.org.
Thanks very much, Karen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. All right. Let's move to my next guest, shall we? All right. we've got Justin Danhof, and he is with the National Center for Public Policy Research, General Counsel, and we are going to talk a bit about some recent event with GMO labeling. Justin, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Karen. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so tell me, we had an anti-GMO proposal recently, and it was denounced at the Safeway shareholder meeting. Now, that doesn't sound like good news to me.
Well, I think it's great news for customers. I think it's great news for Safeway shareholders, and I think it's great news for the public at large. What happened was a group called the Green Century Equity Fund had submitted a proposal to Safeway that would have required the company to slap a scary little label on every product containing GMOs. Safeway, of course, one of the largest grocery stores in the United States. And the gentleman who actually introduced the proposal claimed that there's no scientific evidence that GMOs are safe. So I got up and I spoke in front of the board of directors, the executives, and the shareholders, and I explained the extensive list of independent scientific organizations that have studied GMOs and found them to be perfectly safe for human consumption. And in the end, the shareholders, by about a 90% to 10% margin, agreed with our side of the issue.
All right. Well, I think the shareholders are mostly concerned with profits, and I don't know that they are entirely concerned about much else. I don't want to talk about the scientific evidence about GMOs being safe or not just right now, but I want to tell you why I would like labeling and why I don't care for genetically modified organisms in my food. And I think primarily for me, it's about supporting the current industrial agricultural process with giant agribusiness. I think it's bad practice. I think monocropping on large fields and dumping toxic pesticides and herbicides and using petrochemical fertilizers, which we do not have an unlimited supply of, I think this is not healthy. I don't think it's healthy for biodiversity. I don't think it's healthy for soil. We're degrading our soil. We're seeing a lot of water loss because we're sucking up all the water out of the aquifers. We've got water pollution filled with these toxins from the pesticides and herbicides, and we've got air pollution. And this type of industrial agriculture, a lot of it is growing plants, cereal crops and soy and alfalfa to feed animals, to feed people. It's very inefficient. And what I continually propose and support is an organic system, organic agriculture, where people are eating more plants, less animals. It's better for the planet. It's better for our health. And the last thing about GMOs that we hear a lot from the companies that are researching about them and creating them is that it will help with world hunger. And if you follow any of the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that are out there that are supporting developing nations and their issues with food scarcity, GMOs are not anywhere near the top of the list. They talk about food distribution. They talk about the unfair land distribution where there are a few people that own the land and are growing whatever they want, and the people that work on them grow things that end up being commodity foods that are exported, and they don't even have enough food to feed themselves. So there's a lot of issues that are related with hunger that have nothing to do with the growing of food. And the last thing is that GMOs, if they are going to help the developing nations feed themselves, they're creating a small collection of foods. Most of them aren't what these people are normally eating. They're not culturally based. They're unusual foods, and I think it's really scientifically, culturally, ethically going in the wrong direction.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to address first because you said we can't talk about science, so I'm not sure why we're going to have a debate if we can't bring in the science.
Well, but that's why I would support labeling of foods, because I want to know what has genetically modified foods in it. I also don't think that the science is very good. But
You don't trust the American Medical Association?
I don't.
Okay. You don't trust You don't trust the World Health Organization.
I am suspect.
You don't trust the National Academy of Sciences. You don't trust the American Association for the Advancement of Science. You don't trust the Royal Society of
Medicine. I question everyone.
You question all of these groups?
I question everyone.
Okay, so who do you trust?
Me. I trust myself and my own personal research. There's a handful of people that I believe in terms of what their motivations are when they put things out. But anyone who is linked to a great deal of money, like shareholders of Safeway, I don't respect their opinion.
You don't respect their opinion. Okay, so if these GMOs are causing such devastation and such harm, Safeway would be smart in a business sense to label them, and the shareholders would want it, because otherwise they'd be setting themselves up for incredible class action lawsuits down the road. Just ask the tobacco industry, right?
Okay, we have...
And there's a lot of foresight into this, so think about it. These would be the front runners. And here's my other question. If GMOs are so harmful, why in the heck are we just going to label them? If they're so bad, I don't want them labeled. I would support banning them.
Yeah, well, me
but
too.
But
you know, I just talked
the
with...
Activists, the activists only want them labeled, and
well,
why?
Because
many of them are in the pocket of the organic food lobby. That's the simple
truth. No,
here.
It's just like what I was just
That's
talking with my prior guest in terms of promoting a vegan agenda. He realized that he cannot make big change. So we go for small steps in order to make change.
No,
it's happened in the civil rights movement. It's happened with everything.
No. You and I both know it's a sinister ploy by the organic food lobby, right?
I don't think the organic food lobby is sinister. I want more organic food.
You scare the American people about GMOs, even though they can create a higher yield crop, they can get rid of disease, they can help with world hunger. You scare the people for years on this anti-junk science campaign that's not based on any facts, not based on any evidence. It's just based on fear, because people irrationally use fear in decision-making, right? And then step two, slap a label on those products you've just scared the American people about irrationally. And guess who profits? The organic food lobby. It's not hard to figure out what's going on here.
I think the people who are profiting are the small industrial agriculture group. But I mentioned a lot of points here that I think are really important that are behind promotion of genetically modified foods, which are not related to whether they're safe or not. The problem is with doing studies is they're expensive, and long-term studies are really hard to do. And
well, the European Union took care of that. They did a 10-year study that cost over 200 million euros to exhaustively examine the issue. This was
and
more than 130 research projects covering more than 25 years of combined research involving more than 500 independent research groups. And they determined that GMOs are perfectly safe for human consumption.
Right. Well, I haven't seen any convincing studies that have shown over
the
long term.
Well, then you're burying your head in the sand.
I'm not burying my head. And then the other thing is we are definitely seeing impact.
Type into Google, European Union GMO study. Go look it up. It's 264 pages. I get it. It's a little dense. But they have an executive summary. You can read the conclusion of the report. It's not complicated to find this research.
And we've seen research that shows that a lot of negative things are happening to bugs because some of the GMOs have pesticides built into them that are supposed to kill, and then they do kill, and then they start subsequently killing other pests. We've got a lot of bad things going on at a microscopic level.
Let's talk about killing and death. Let's talk about how us Westerners who are activists on this issue, the food zealots, I want to call them, have scared the government of India into banning golden rice. Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about golden rice.
Let's talk about human
suffering. Let's talk about helping India grow foods that are native to their land.
Yeah,
Let's talk about children going blind.
Talk about children who are malnourished.
Okay,
and
there's a whole lot of it.
Vitamin A infused rice.
Yeah, so grow foods that naturally contain vitamin A that aren't going to give them an overdose of vitamin A, and where they have to consume so much rice in order to get a normal level of vitamin A. It's just nonsense. There are plenty of naturally growing plants that have vitamin A that are native to the area, and with just the right amount of technology and financial resources, they can grow those plants. They don't need some high-tech food that is alien to them. That's just crazy. And
rice
as I mentioned before, the problem with hunger and food
is
distribution.
Alien.
It's not some superfood that we have to start giving to the world. And I just wanted to mention that in this press release, you refer to the third world. We don't talk about them as third world anymore. It's developing nations.
Wow, I'm glad your political correction really just, you know, smugness coming through on such an epic level. But, you know, continue.
Yeah, well, it's
look down your nose at me as I try and help the developing world, and you try and keep your thumb on them with your junk science. I'm going to use real science and real facts to try and help people.
Okay, well, then the other problem is all of the farmers that can't keep up with the debt that they have to pay for all the seeds to plant these patented foods. When their farms
are you are you a patent lawyer? I mean, we can debate the patent issue. I mean, where we want, but it's a highly intricate legal issue. It's a whole separate
It's so intricate that the farmers don't realize what they're getting into when they purchase the seeds, and they go into high debt, and then the crops don't yield.
Well, hey.
Hey, well, too bad for them. We really care about them, right?
Yeah. Well,
anyway,
you probably look down your noses at them too.
The issues with GMOs, There is the question of safety, which many of us have not been convinced of, and there are many more issues, which is the support of industrial agricultural procedures, which are destroying our soil, too dependent on petrochemical fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides. And what about the fact that the GMOs kept telling us it would wean us off of using toxic herbicides and pesticides, and yet all the Roundup Ready products need more Roundup Ready every year because the weeds are getting smarter, and we have super weeds.
Hey, I'll just keep working to present facts. I'll keep working to present science. I will keep working on the promise of GMOs. You can keep spreading junk science. You can keep misinforming folks. And we'll just part ways at that, because you started the debate by saying we don't want to talk about science. I listed dozens of independent studies that I hope your listeners go look at, even if you won't, to verify what we all know, that GMOs are perfectly safe. There's lots of other. Are you interested in mutation breeding? Because that's a lot scarier to a lot of people, but nobody seems to talk about that. But, you know, that would involve educating yourself on another scientific angle, so I know that's not up your alley.
I have a master's degree in chemical engineering, and I read and understand all of the science. The reason why I said that I didn't want to touch on the science is because there really hasn't been a lot of good science in either direction, and I'd rather focus on much easier to understand issues that are so important, and GMOs support the bad practices of giant agribusiness. So I would prefer to have them labeled to know which products they are, so that I don't have to buy them.
The organic products are labeled, so go buy them.
I do, and I wish that there was more government action to make them more affordable for everyone, so that we wouldn't have agriculture that's based on toxic pesticides and herbicides and petrochemicals. That's
well,
all. Justin, it's been great talking to you. And keep doing what you're doing, and I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
Thank you. For those who want to read the science, visit us at nationalcenter.org. For those who don't, keep listening. Thank you.
Okay, bye. Well, there you go. Wasn't that fun? Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in a few minutes to talk about choosing raw with Jenna Hamshaw. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be delicious. Be right back. Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, Part 2, on August 5th, 2014. Oh, gosh, I need to breathe deeply here, because that was kind of exciting little back and forth there a moment ago. Let me know what you think of that and anything else we talk about here. You can email me at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Right, now let's relax, shall we, and start talking about my favorite subject, food, with Jenna Hamshaw, CCN, a former book editor turned clinical nutritionist. She has contributed to Veg News, O Magazine, Whole Living Daily, Food 52, and other publications. Her website is choosingraw.com. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good. Love your book.
Thank you so much. Perfect. I'm so glad you like it.
I haven't had a cookbook author on in a while. I do love talking about food, and I love talking about delicious food, and people need to know every day how to make healthy, delicious food. But I've been concentrating on the uglier side of food for a while, and let's just talk about delicious, healthy food.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about it.
What's your story?
Well, the food in my book is vegan food, obviously.
Yay.
It's 125 vegan recipes. A lot of them are raw, as the title suggests. I'm not a strict raw foodist the way some people are, so I eat plenty of cooked food. I'll pretty much eat anything so long as it's vegan. But I call myself a raw foods enthusiast, which essentially means that I love raw food recipes, and I get a big kick out of preparing them. So there's a big emphasis on raw food in the book. And the idea behind that is not to encourage anyone to go raw, and it's not necessarily to encourage anyone to go vegan if that's not what they're hoping to do. But it is an effort to encourage everyone to eat more vegetables, to consider plant-based food. You know, if you've ever thought about doing Meatless Monday or just cooking more vegetarian dinners but you kind of don't know where to start, I really wanted to give people an accessible, fun, inspiring resource. And, of course, the emphasis is also on foods that are healthful. So whole foods, foods that are made with sort of minimally prepared ingredients, lots of really healthful choices like quinoa, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and, you know, a sort of an emphasis on foods that are nourishing as well as really delicious and tasty.
Well, the challenge I think all of us know is that people need to find their kitchens.
Yes.
And I haven't said that in a while, but I need to say it because that's, you know, I was talking to Matt Ball earlier, and how do we work our activism to encourage people to go vegan? And how many times have I heard people say, "I can't be like you.
Yeah.
I can't do that."
Yeah.
And I think it's just a fear of not knowing where their kitchen is.
Absolutely.
What to do with it when they find it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's twofold. I think that's a huge part of it. It's just not that people are so out of touch with preparing their own food that they kind of don't remember how. And to them, the idea of cooking vegan food just seems so exotic and so out there. But I think also people, you know, that's part of what people are so scared of when they're afraid of going vegan, is the idea that they're going to have to be home making everything from scratch. So the question becomes, well, what do I do if I love restaurants? What do I do if I love to travel? What do I do if I have a really active social life and I don't want to be home, you know, boiling quinoa all the time? And I think one thing that's really important to remind people is veganism is now a lifestyle that is not only accessible within the confines of your kitchen. It is becoming so much easier to take veganism out there in the real world and enjoy vegan food in restaurants, find options on menus all over the place, find vegan grocery items at mainstream supermarkets. You know, when I went vegan, it was over 7 years ago, and it was much harder at the time to eat in restaurants and or to find, you know, something like Earth Balance at any grocery store that wasn't a health food store or Whole Foods. Now I can walk into any Safeway and find something like Earth Balance or soy milk or almond milk or anything like that. So I think what people also need to remember is, sure, you know, it's important to connect with food in the kitchen and in the home space, but veganism also is not a request that you kiss your social life goodbye. You can be vegan out there, out and about, and it doesn't have to be a choice that makes you siphon yourself off from friends, coworkers, et cetera.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Safeway. I don't know if you were listening to the program just before this, but we were talking about how Safeway shareholders rejected an anti-GMO proposal. So we're glad for Safeway for having all the wonderful soy milks and faux meats and all the vegan alternatives. That's really wonderful, but not happy about the anti-GMO proposal that they rejected. But oh well. Let's move on. You mentioned that you had done a moment of eating all raw, and I did it too for about 2 years. And
oh wow!
That's
a good long rough.
It is, and I really enjoyed it. But you know, I love the way I eat now, and that's a whole food, plant-based, vegan diet, lots of greens, cooked and raw food. But in thumbing through your book, I reminded myself of a couple of things I used to make that I don't make anymore, and I really need to make them again, and that is flaxseed crackers.
Mm-hmm.
So wonderful and not difficult at all, especially since, I mentioned this a while ago, but I have this gas oven at home, and I didn't know for 10 years that it had a dehydrator option on it.
Oh, wow.
And I even had one of those Excalibur dehydrators during my raw period right next to the oven that had a dehydrator option, and I didn't know it. Anyway,
that
so
is
I can
so
dehydrate.
Funny.
And the other recipe is the buckwheaties.
Yeah, absolutely. That's sort of a staple. I feel like that's like a raw food staple dish. You know, there are a couple of, in my book, I list sort of 15 essentials at the beginning, and I was trying to think of all the dishes that are just kind of like raw food essentials or greatest hits or what have you, and flax crackers was one of them, cashew cheese was another one, a sort of basic green smoothie, zucchini pasta. I mean, I feel like these are the dishes that you're going to meet very quickly if you start getting into raw food, and they're sort of some of the most foundational recipes of a raw food diet.
Right. Buckwheaties with like a nut milk on top of it is
mm-hmm.
just so delicious.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely delicious. Such a good breakfast.
Right. I'm sorry. Move over Captain Crunch and cow's milk. Blech.
Right. Exactly. Well, and as soon as you get used to the way something like buckwheaties tastes, it's amazing how you'll go back eating conventional cereal and it just tastes so terrible. You know, it tastes so sugary and just so not wholesome. One of the things I really like about raw food in particular is that I think it forces you to kind of connect with whole foods in this very intimate, powerful way. And it can really train your taste buds to start appreciating just the beauty of really unadulterated food. And that was one thing that I took away from raw food very strongly. And it's one of the things that has really stayed with me.
I think it's easiest to introduce more raw foods during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good time to do it because the summer, when you're in places like where I am in New York, where it's hot and we
mm-hmm.
sweat and it's important to stay hydrated, you can hydrate so well with raw foods that are filled with water.
Absolutely.
And this idea,
absolutely.
You know, it's great to drink water, but it's better to get it in your food.
Yeah, well, or it's important to also get it in your food. You know, I mean, I think, of course, it's important to hydrate with real water. But, yeah, it's true. I mean, I think a lot of folks eat very dehydrating diets. You know, it's a lot of sort of refined grains and, you know, meats and salty foods, prepared foods, microwave foods. You know, if you think about that, they're all really dehydrating. And raw foods are just so rich in water, which is great.
Okay, you have a section in your book on myths and misconceptions,
mm-hmm.
which is so important. And in this world of the Internet, where people can find any bit of information and latch onto it, some of it's good and some of it's not so good. And the myths, boy, some of them just go on and on and on and on. No matter what we do to combat
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
But you have a few good ones here. So a lot of people think about detoxing and doing a
yeah.
detox. What do you think about
yeah.
detoxes?
Oh, I mean, I don't think it is. I don't really think there is such a thing. I mean, there is, from a medical standpoint, such a thing, and that is detoxification from very particular kinds of drugs. So, yes, it is possible for people who are addicted to certain kinds of narcotics to go through a detoxification process or who have been, you know, exposed to certain kinds of toxins. But when it comes to the idea that our bodies are crawling with, you know, every single particle of bad air we've ingested since we were kids and remnants and sort of sludge from all these years of terrible diets and booze and caffeine, and that if we somehow eat green vegetables, we will purge these terrible toxins from our bodies, that is really a myth. That is a myth that has been created in certain health circles. And the idea that somehow, you know, detox is a part of the process of going vegan, which is something you hear all the time. You know, as you go vegan, you'll detox all the years of dairy out of your system and you'll feel stuffy and get headaches. That's really no true. There's no validated scientific evidence to support this. Of course, a lot of people do feel differently as they adopt plant-based diets, and that makes a lot of sense. For most people, they're getting a lot more hydration. They're eating a lot more fiber, so there can be some GI disruption at the beginning. And some people might feel headachy or a little bit tired because they're used to eating really sugary or stimulating foods. And if they start to eat a healthier diet, of course, they're not getting quite as much as of the sugar and the stimulation. But there is no detoxification of sort of, you know, insidious toxins happening. And well, as much as that's kind of a fun idea, I don't really think there's much to it.
Well, even if there are things we want to remove from our bodies, it doesn't happen quickly. It takes a long time. I know personally I went through a romp with advanced ovarian cancer, and I had chemotherapy. And it took a year to feel, to be 100% rid of all the side effects of chemotherapy.
Yeah, of course.
Now, you know, what was it? Was it the toxins that were still in my body? I don't know what it was, but it took a year. And that was a year on a super healthy whole foods, plant-based vegan diet, eating a lot of green foods. It takes time. So these 1 week, 2 week, whatever detoxes, they're a joke.
Absolutely. And also the idea that it's, you know, it's healthy to just drink juice for a week. It's really not. I mean, metabolically and in terms of nutrition needs, that's not healthy for our bodies. We need a lot more nourishment than that. And, you know, I also, one thing I say to my nutrition clients all the time, because I'm still practicing nutritionist, is this. It's actually really easy to just drink juice for a week. Typically, it's some packaged cleanse that you bought, you know, from some provider, and they deliver all the juices to you, and you, all you have to do is put them in your fridge and drink them when you want them, you know, and or pre-prepared foods or whatever. That's really easy. Someone is holding your hand and walking you through it. What's really hard is teaching yourself how to eat everything in moderation, but eat healthily overall, day after day after day, how to prepare the food yourself, how to prep and cook and pay attention to your diet. That's really hard, and you're not going to learn that from some sort of one-week detox fat diet. It's the kind of thing that you have to invest time and energy in teaching yourself.
Now, you mentioned in the beginning of the book that you're from a Greek background.
I am, indeed.
And I can't help but think of the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah. So the funny thing about that is my Yaya, my grandmother, actually said those very words to me when I told her that I was going to stop eating red meat, because I stopped eating red meat as a child. I went
vegetarian. That's okay, later. I'll make lamb. Did she say
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and that, I mean, she actually said, well, you'll still eat lamb, right? So, I mean, that movie, while it abounds with stereotypes, a lot of them are very close to the truth.
That's too funny. We say that a lot. We love the actress Andrea Martin, and she was the one who said that in the movie when the future son-in-law, or she was an aunt of the bride-to-be or something, and he said, I'm a vegetarian, and she said, what? No meat? That's okay. I'll make lamb.
Yeah, exactly.
We say that all the time, and it's true. Oh, my goodness. But she's since learned the difference,
yes.
I imagine. There's a lot of wonderful Greek foods, actually, that are vegetarian and raw.
Absolutely. I think it really depends, too, on the kind of Greek food. You know, I think in popular imagination at this point, the Greek or Mediterranean diet is all like, you know, cannellini beans and tomatoes and olive oil and greens and fish. And that is certainly a huge part of Greek food. The Greek food that I was raised on was the sort of heavier home cooking side of Greek food. So it was a ton of lamb and, you know, keftede burgers and kasseri cheese and lots of pastry. I mean, Greek food can also be incredibly rich. But I think if you're looking at particular kinds of Greek food, yeah, of course, there are wonderful salads and lots of delicious sort of dips and spreads and mezze or appetizers. So, yeah, it's really easy to eat at a Greek restaurant if you eat a plant-based diet, that's for sure.
Now, you also mentioned early on in your book your story where you it finally acknowledged you had an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you've made peace with your food.
I have, and it took a long time. My journey into plant-based eating was a huge part of it, you know, which is interesting because I think oftentimes it's assumed that people with eating disorder histories really shouldn't be eating any kind of diet that's selective, if you will, or excludes any foods, because eating everything is supposedly, you know, an important part of the recovery process. But for me, actually, connecting with the ethics and the meaning and the value of my food through veganism really invested food with a particular kind of beauty that I had never seen in the food I ate before, and it was what helped me recover. And I think that recognizing, too, that my food choices went outside of just me and me alone, you know, that they impact the environment and animals and the food system at large, that helped me see eating as a way of making choices that could actually do active good in the world. And the effect of all these things was to really shift my relationship with food away from being this very kind of guilty, shameful thing that I had always felt about eating, to being an act that I felt a lot of joy around. It was a long process. I had an eating disorder for a very long time, and I relapsed a couple of times. But really, after I discovered plant-based diet, I was and I have remained relapse-free, which is really wonderful.
That's a beautiful story, and I'm glad.
Thank you.
Yeah, the relapse thing is kind of the scary part.
Sure, it is. And I mean, you know, eating disorder recovery, as I always say to people, it's a long, winding road. It's not really, we sort of want there to be a clear endpoint one day, you know, a before and after. I am recovered, and I was sick then, I'm recovered now. But for most people, it's an ongoing process. And I think everyone who's had an eating disorder has to remember that relapse is always possible. So we have to remain accountable and keep all of our tools that we use to support ourselves in place, whether that's therapy or having your friends, your partner, your family help to keep you accountable. So I always am very conscious and aware of the fact that a relapse could happen, but that's also part of why I pay so much attention to my relationship with food, and I really work to take care of my body through food, and I, you know, have a lot of tools in my life that I've created to help me stay healthy.
This is something that applies to everything. Everyone has their challenges. Everybody has their issues. And the ones that thrive and succeed are the ones that have a toolbox, the ones that have a strategy, the ones that are mindful and recognize what's going on.
Absolutely. People who are sort of conscious of the problem. Because you're right, you know, whether it's an eating disorder or an addiction or some kind of, you know, some sort of tendency, whatever difficulty it is that you face in your life, having that set of tools is so important. So, yeah, I really appreciate what you say, and I think it goes well beyond food.
Now, I'm really into prevention when it comes to illnesses, and we do see a lot more eating disorders, especially amongst young women. Do you have any ideas on how we might prevent those from happening?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, a couple of things. You know, I think one thing that's so important is we live in a culture where it's just very okay to openly talk about body and appearance. And I think there's probably too much conversation surrounding this. You know, what triggered my eating disorder was just, you know, teasing as a kid, and also the fact that people just felt like it was okay. I had been a very healthy kid growing up. I gained a little bit of weight when I was just about to enter my teen years, like a lot of preteens do, and it probably would have come off with time, but I was going through a phase where I was a little heavier, and the commentary is really what triggered it. And I think one thing that I've noticed through recovery, through relapsing, is that there is just ongoing commentary about the way people feel so at liberty to talk about the way other people look, and I think that really needs to change, and that sort of body commentary needs to be curtailed in a big way. I also think that, you know, encouraging young women to take pleasure in their food is so important. I can't tell you, I hear from a lot of people who have had eating disorders through my website because I write about mine so often, and so many of them say that what started their, you know, relationship with food on a bad track, whether that was an eating disorder or binge eating, you know, anorexia, whatever, was that at some point someone had made them feel bad about their appetite or bad about the fact that they like to eat.
I want to end on a happy note. So we've come to the end of the program, Jenna, and I thank you for writing Choosing Raw. It's beautiful, with great pictures by Hannah Kaminsky and delicious, delicious recipes. And I'm happy to hear about your journey. Find out more about Jenna at choosingraw.com. Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you, my listeners. It's been another episode of It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And everyone together, have a delicious week. Bye.